Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Trick Podcast with Joey and Golsa TV on this beautiful Thursday, June 18, here in the LA area. It's noon, high noon, although it's only 63 degrees here in LA, which to us, you know, is like high winter here. So we're thankful for this beautiful cloudy day and grateful for you, our partners and our audience. I want to encourage you to leave a comment below. If you are on YouTube, on Twitch, on Periscope, Twitter, Instagram Live, YouTube Live, on my website, or on Facebook Live, I want to just welcome you and tell you thank you for being here this morning. As I said, I did a couple of devotions that I also streamed live, so thank you for being here. We have people that have been tuning in from Singapore, from other parts of the world, and of course here in the U.S. But today I'm so pumped. You know, obviously we've been talking over the last few weeks, seemingly daily, about race in America. And as a man of color, this is something that is personal. But more than that, I long to provide an alternative or a different perspective to things that maybe we're hearing. And what I specifically mean is the Asian American maybe perspective in all this, especially with George Floyd, is very important. And so on the screen right now, you're seeing an article that I recently read that a friend of mine, a dear friend who I'll introduce here in a second, sent me that says, "Officer who stood by as George Floyd died highlights complex Asian American Black relations." And as you know, one of the officers is of a Hmong background, Asian American young man, and he, I believe, has been arrested. I could be wrong, but I think that he's going through some sort of trial, and there's a whole legal process that he's dealing with. But even besides that, the Asian American experience is one of both privilege and also of discovery, of needing to be heard. And what I'm so thankful for is that this George Floyd experience and this painful situation has given voice to Asian Americans to say, hey, me too. I also have been through similar things, and because of many reasons, perhaps I haven't been able or even perhaps allowed to speak my truth. Yes, yes, racism, yes, pain, yes, sadness, yes, frustration. And even though I want to forgive and I want to be a part of the solution, let me start with me. And so I want to bring a dear friend of mine. His name is John Waters. He is an educator, a vice principal in the Denver, Colorado area. I actually was on staff with him at a church there in the area. I love him dearly, his wife and family. So John Waters, I want to just make sure that I have all the technology here. There it is. Let's see here. Welcome to the show, John. How are you, my dear friend?
Good to see you. Thank you for having me on, Trig.
Absolutely, man. You look beautiful in red, by the way. Is that your favorite color?
I've been told it does look good on me, so that's more to the credit of my wife than my own choosing here. So thank you.
That's right. Well, you know, let's get into it. First of all, as I was saying, I want to just tell the audience to, again, leave a comment below if you have any questions about Asian and Black relations, or just simply your own story as a Korean or a Chinese or any sort of Asian descent. Leave a comment below, and John and I will try to assist in any way that we can. And also, I want to just, again, remind the audience to share this broadcast. Let everyone know that we're on the air, especially if you know someone who would relate to this. But John, let's just start with a little bit of us. You know, when we first met, we were both in the Denver, Arvada area there in Colorado, in Denver metro area. And I believe we were the only two, I mean, I could be mistaken, quote, pastors of color, maybe in the history of that church. Maybe let's just start with a little bit of context. What was that like for you just in the church to be a man of color, of Asian and maybe, quote, white descent? Explain that to us. What was that like?
So I guess I'll give you a little context of kind of who I am for the viewer's sake. At 6 months of age, I was adopted out of Seoul, Korea, and into Sacramento, Sacramento area family, by the last name of Waters, which became obviously my name. My Korean name is Lim Shun Suk. But took my parents' name as they adopted me in the United States. So we moved around a little bit, spent time in Chicago, and then out to Denver. Grew up in what I would consider to be a pretty white and affluent context, had a lot of friends, had private school experience, had a very limited public school experience. And so when I kind of moved on to become the adult man that I was beginning, 18 plus, knew I needed to work, knew I needed to experience college, knew I needed to be outside of obviously family and familiar. So went to the University of Colorado and got a degree in history, and then have since gone back for a grad degree in public administration. But engaged with the church pretty early. It was something that was sort of a part of the DNA of my family growing up, and then something that I embraced through some experiences, one of which was personal loss of a family member, my brother.
Oh, we lost you there for a second and froze up. Let's see if we can get you back.
I'm
frozen.
Matter.
There you go. I think you were frozen there for a second.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
You're fine now. You're good.
But the loss of my brother when he was 17 years of age drew me into thinking about the eternal, thinking about things from a spiritual impact, not just because of what I needed to do to evangelize or proselytize or share Jesus, but just because Jesus actually became the most important thing, and because everything else was out of my control at that point, certainly. And because of that, I share my story and my life and my abilities with others. So that centered around students for a while. And then when it got to a place where I was invited to join a big church, I felt like I could make an impact and a difference in some of the organizational leadership pieces and some of the training and some of the using, in fact, my minority status as a way to welcome others. Even though maybe my minority experience was different than those coming through the door, it gave me a platform, I guess, to make what's obvious something that I was willing to embrace and willing to let people ask questions and be exposed to. And so obviously when you were on staff with me, I think that was the very limited. I mean, I live in a county that is 80% white. By the last census in 19, I think it was. And so, you know, that's, and I followed by Hispanic, and then a very small minority of 3% being Asian, and then even fewer than that, Black or African American. So, I knew I was colorful, because there were very few other people around that looked like me, and that were certainly in a church working, from the stage, or even behind me. And so, it was definitely good to see another, brown person and somebody who was, embracing of that and had a story of your own, which you told me almost immediately, which I think bonded us quickly. And so I value and cherish our friendship and what our diversity as part of that story means.
Well, let's go back even a step further, go back to really the origin story of who you are as a man, and especially to maybe tease out some of the things you mentioned last month, I think, or at the beginning of this month, June 1st. You posted a very meaningful and I think heartfelt and very logical post about your experience as an Asian American man, as a man of Korean descent. And then I read some of the posts and the comments, and I think they were very positive. But at the same time, it seemed like there was perhaps a, wow, I didn't know that, John. But before even the post, tell me, what has it been like to be John Waters in this George Floyd era? And maybe even if you're anything in your past connects to that, please walk us through maybe from your origin story to George Floyd.
Yeah, so I think my experience with my own race has been, because I grew up white, essentially, I had exposure all through my life to first generation Korean, which I count as a blessing and a privilege to be around that. And my parents never wanting to protect their whiteness by attaining my exposure to people of my same color. And they've even asked, and in a sense, do you feel like we did enough, or do you feel like we ever deprived you of your ethnicity or of your own history. And I never felt that. So there was no animosity or no, I wish I was somewhere else. Or I wish I was more Korean. But because of my last name, because of my voice, because of my dress, because of the circle I ran in, because of the relative middle upper class status, comparatively, I did feel different than other minorities in their experiences. And so when I encountered racism, which happened as early as young childhood, and it's all the stereotypes. It's the pulling eyes back. It's the kids running up doing kung moves at me and trying to mimic the Asian inflection, asking me if I knew Bruce Lee or Jackie Chan or certain other stereotypes that are not as camera appropriate, but just things that hurt, but I didn't really understand how to deal with them. And so I have always minimized by sort of a callousness my own race, my own appearance. And because of that, I think I grew up feeling like white people have a point. Like, I'm the visitor, I'm different, but I'm also enjoying a lot of the things that my assimilation has afforded me. And I don't know that you sort of bite the hand that feeds you in that. I think when it started to get where I felt a level of personal offense and sadness was when it got into my college years, when I was being pulled over by law enforcement for things that other people wouldn't be pulled over for. I was pulled over for two different license plates violations that weren't even relevant, not even moving violations and not a first offense, a secondary offense kind of a situation. And as I started analyzing that even recently, it hit me that other than the driver, why is somebody pulling somebody over for a license plate related violation? And they weren't even expired. I mean, we're talking a license plate light and an errant pullover of not having a front license plate. Like, who gets pulled over for this? So other than the driver and the skin color, it felt discriminatory. It felt profiling. To have friends sort of make fun of the fact that I was Asian in some ways was sort of passed off as, well, that's just what buddies do. But I'm not sure that that's always how it was meant, because it was always pulling out, you're the different one. Like, you're the, but I've just always kind of put that aside. And in my earliest childhood experience of flat out, offense, where I was actually involved in summer camp, camper, not as a leader. And I was actually attacked, by a group of African American black boys that came up to me from behind and for whatever reason kicked and pushed me and knocked me down some stairs. And it took my leader and a couple of friends to actually get them away from me. And I don't know, like, to this day, what they identified in me that needed to be pulled out. But I have always had a deep-seated suspicion of and an underlying animosity toward African American men, because of that experience in our boyhood, in our childhood. And that wasn't, none of those people have names to me. I have no idea. And I don't know why that happened to this day, but my relationship with that community and specifically the men of that community has been forever tarnished by that incident, where I felt to be the victim and they were the aggressors, and that never caused me to provoke or prompt anything, but it has also never given me empathy. It's never given me a joining in of a sort of a co-plight that people of color in this country have experienced. And so when the George Floyd hit, video surfaced and the conversations began, and then this article came out saying, hey, as an Asian American, we need to talk about the fact that this guy is Asian American standing there allowing a white person to essentially kill a black man in the streets. It just struck me differently because the points that were being made, though very general, resonated with me. There was an experience there that I shared, and it caused me to identify my stereotypes and my preconceptions of dating back to my middle school years, why I never really cared. Rodney King, never really cared. And that was my first experience as an adult with racism directed at the African-American community. And in that specific instance, obviously law enforcement, which continues to be a theme in this. But that's never been something that I had empathy for. It was just their plight. It was their battle. It was their thing. I hadn't necessarily experienced that. But then as I examine my life, I have. And not to that degree. If we're ranking, you know, experience, I've never been near death or never had a friend killed over the color of their skin. But I have definitely suffered racial discrimination at the hands of black and white. And I think I've always been like, hey, what about me? Right. Like, my experiences are valid. And it wasn't until the George Floyd incident happened and this author wrote for Apple News and NBC. No, it's okay. Asian people need to speak too. And we've been silenced a lot because we just are as white as it gets as far as our willingness to assume. And that may not be a positive thing.
Mm-hmm. So I love what you're saying. There's a couple of things. You know, first, there's your own experience, which I actually want to go back to a bit. And then there's you as a Asian person looking at an African-American person experience pain and death. And then even looking at it past that, now, how do we advocate? But what is it like to actually speak of your experience with racism?
Give me that question again.
So in other words, my guess is that it's not the easiest thing to say, hey, me too. I mean, in every area of right. life, whether it's a woman who says, hey, this guy, or a right. man of color who says, hey, me too. What has that been like the last few weeks to post that right. experience on Facebook to talk about this thing openly? Is it the first yeah. time?
It is the first time I have ever shared with, you know, if you can call it the friends on Facebook, friends. It is the first time that I've ever been willing and really able to share the fact that I identify with discrimination, that I have had acts of racism, including physical aggression directed at me by other minorities, by white people, and by law enforcement. And it's been very cathartic to get that emotion out in a way that wasn't expressed through emotion only. Mm-hmm. And so I think by being able to just post an article without, a snarky commentary attached to it, the dialogue that I have had since then, from all colors, all walks of life, including rainbow, like it has been the most uplifting and truly felt like a universal support of people coming together saying, yeah, there's a problem here. I had no idea that minorities could hate on each other. and by the way, Asians can hate on other Asians too. And I've also experienced that. But to experience in that post, the comments and the interactions that happened after that of people saying, I'm starting to understand, like tell me more, instead of just shutting it down and saying, well, that's just some guy who doesn't really experience racism, or some guy that, oh, he's just a friend, you know, whatever. Or, well, he's not really a minority. He doesn't count. He's not black. It's been inspiring to experience the partnership or the equality that has come from conversation. I didn't have anybody try to explain away or defend or marginalize or flat out tell me I'm wrong for either feeling what I felt or that my experience didn't happen. And so that was very validating, that for whatever reason, and I rarely interact with social media on Facebook, certainly with the politics and things like this. But I don't know, there was a compulsion that did come from within, not just because of my personal experience, but I really felt like for the first time, the Lord was giving me an opportunity to share things, that were just personal and personal in my journey as a man, as a Korean, as a Christ follower, and as somebody who's loved. And that's always been my experience of, that's always what I've not wanted to acknowledge, is that people can love me. And this allowed me to see that people love me specifically in this area because I was willing to share and because I'm Korean. And that was being, they were giving me the opportunity to put that out in front for the first time, I feel. Because I chose to be, I guess, brave in that, instead of deciding that I don't want people to see my color. I actually embrace the fact that I am a minority and I do identify with a lot of what's happening. And I have a lot to learn in how other races have experienced this, with each other and with, Caucasian, people as well. And there is a lot of education, but that's only going to come through conversation. And so that's why this was so important to me as well, is to be able to have this conversation with you, my friend, and to be heard here as well.
That's right. I'm glad for it, of course. So now let's move to the article itself. So Asian American Black, there's maybe historically assumptions of rifts. Obviously, there's a personal story in your life. Or maybe there are historic things, facts of unity that we don't even know about. What can you tell us experientially, you know, in your life? Obviously, we know about camp and what happened to you. But what is your perspective right now in terms of the African-American experience? And maybe you studied history. Is there anything in history that you can even draw from to say, hey, here is some common ground?
Yeah, I think I spent a lot of my life, again, the LA riots were the first time that as an adult I understood that racism could become violent, because I didn't live in the life. I wasn't even born when ERA happened. And, you know, you almost feel guilty watching movies to catch up with a perspective of what happened, or as a history person to read about, but actually experience or try to empathize or identify with that level of struggle. And then have not completely mirror my own. I didn't have to fight for anything. I walked into this country as an adopted child, for whatever reason was going on, as many Asian Americans who have an adoption story, whether it was escape or whether it was orphan, which was my case. It's just different. It's a different experience, in relation to race and acceptance and assimilation and law and things. So, I think when the LA riots happened, a lot of the, I focused on, right or wrong, was a lot of the people in the neighborhoods that were trying to succeed, were a lot of the Korean grocers, people that had tried to make something of their circumstances or situation of their neighborhood. And those were all looted, or mm-hmm. violence was done to those people for trying to protect their own places of business, knowing that the system wasn't going to refund them for whatever losses they incurred from that, that era in American and California history. And so there was some animosity there, specifically toward the Black community of, I don't care where you're from, don't behave like this. And you have done this to my brothers and sisters in the same way. There is a brotherhood or a sisterhood with other minorities. And so I resented that, but I didn't have any friends or family that were affected directly by that. I just watched it on the news, like a lot of people. And that stood with me as I resent that. This is how people behave. And there was a glimpse of that across the country in this most recent uprising with with the George Floyd thing was, but my mindset was totally different in that. And I, hopefully that's a spiritual and a person maturity that's impacted that response this time.
I'd love to know that's what kind of changed. Maybe after you're done with this, you know, kind of what got you to this place of greater awareness.
I think that since the time when I was physically singled out, I have had multiple black men who I admire and respect and have treated me well. And so there was a redemptive restoration of trust for those individuals and for those circumstances that those individuals operated in. And they have no idea.
Sure.
Some of them I'm not even in touch with. They have no idea. But I think that they impacted or changed my mind or contributed to that where I am and where I sit today. But I think that made me also think that instead of being defensive about when the Black Lives Matter movement started, I was sort of skeptical and was not empathetic. And then the coronavirus hit, not that there's a linear progression here, but the coronavirus hit and the Wu flu and the Chinese virus and these things, and then Asian Americans were being attacked or ridiculed or resented that we somehow, all of us, as if people can tell the difference, singled us out as you're the reason, you're the cause, you're the problem. And I didn't hear any black voices advocating for the Asian American. And I resented that. And so when the George Floyd thing happened, my first knee-jerk reaction was to get angry, not because of what was being done, to this man, but because, oh, here we go again. One community, one minority group is going to get all attention and all the validating and all of the take action and let's change and Asian people are just going to assimilate some more. We're going to stand behind the scenes. We're going to watch it happen. We're not going to
literally
heal.
Watch it happen, right?
Exactly.
Meaning, you know, visually we could say, oh, see, there it goes again.
Yeah. And we're not going to be out front. And then this article hit and I went, yeah, I subtly did notice that when the first video showed up, like that guy is Asian. And that's going to be a problem. So keep your mouth shut, John. But then this wrote and I went, yep, no, that's convicting. And I need to embrace that. I need to live in that. And as they say, lean into it because this is what I feel. And there's reasons for it. But in no world would Jesus allow me to harbor those feelings and not partner with somebody else in their downtroddenness, in their request for help. Jesus's response was all put a hand out there and to uplift. And I didn't feel that until this last round. And I went, okay, for whatever reason, God, I'm in it this time. Wow. And I'm not going to be quiet and I'm not going to look the other way. And I'm not going to hide my resentment, but I'm also not going to run away from how I feel. And we'll see what happens. And so the Lord's got me through some social media stuff and through even where we sit today, being able to share some of the things that are important to me and my story. Whether other people have the same or not, this is who I am. And it's not just my truth. This actually is how many people of Asian descent feel, I think, in this country, as I've talked to friends and people that have sort of walked through this process, but have not necessarily embraced it. Quiet has always been the sort of Asian response to these kinds of things. If we don't stick out, then no one will come after us. But that also puts us in a weak and powerless position. And I didn't want to be that this time. I felt like I needed to be out there with this one.
It's powerful. I heard an interview recently how speaking our truth actually make us more human. Even though we fear, it'll make us less human, meaning more angry or more complaining. more negative, but actually it's the opposite. And that's what I see in you, such a humanity in a positive, wholeness, joyful, life-giving way, which is the antithesis of what we fear that will happen if we speak up. I also am struck by the need that we all have to speak up on behalf of our brothers. When someone didn't speak up on your behalf when you were being, whether kicked around or whether, you know, what happened with George Floyd, and hey, there's this Asian man and who's speaking up for us Asian people. The value of speaking up, a lot of people say, well, you know, why mess with this? What's the point? Well, we all have friends that need to hear from us. I'm convicted by that. Like, okay, I need to just even, I have a friend who's dealing with cancer. His wife is, and I'm thinking, I need to be calling him. So it applies at all levels of the need to be a friend. Now, speaking of friendship and faith, obviously we both, as men of faith, we've had our ups and downs with the organized religion part of it. But putting that aside, how has Jesus shown up in this, in your life? What has he been saying to you in light of this? You kind of hinted at it, but go deeper into that.
My wife has given me, also as a Christ follower, she has never not listened or never decided that that's just his battle and he needs to deal with that. I mean, there's appropriate levels of that, and that she's not Korean. But she has definitely walked alongside me and has given our children, who are mixed race, freedom to say who they are, when you have to check a box. And, so that's been the freedom that we experience in our home, and the freedom that my children experience is because of her. And so that's been a maturation on her side, of things from the beginning. And so that's been something that has encouraged me with how she responds to the Lord by, in many ways, just letting me vent, not just with this topic, but with others. But I think that conviction seems like a very old school, Sunday school kind of word, but for the first time, as Jesus relates to race, and I want to be very careful with how that's phrased, because, you know, people, well, he was Jewish, and, you know, and so they call race into this in some way.
Right.
And obviously he's the example of compassion, of joining in struggle, of advocating for people that have no voice. God put on my heart for some reason this time that, I think it was through some of the voices that were even televised, we are asking for your help.
Wow.
We cannot do this on our own, because, the power shift has to be a participated in. This cannot be just one against another and forcing change through garbage legislation or through affirmative action decisions or through whatever's politically correct currently. And I think in that, like, who am I to somebody down who's asking for help? And that's something that I've become more sensitive to, not just in this, but in my life, is certainly there are many people to help, and many people that I have to remove my judgment, or my preconceptions or misconceptions over why they may need help. And I was able to do that in this one for I think only spiritual reasons. My default is not that. My default is very, make it on your own, self-made person, you know. But this one was different. I feel like my help was to teach some of my people in my circles, whether it be social media or elsewhere, that I'm not unlike other minorities, and my struggle has been the same in some areas and very different in others. But as far as equality, this must happen. This must be. And until we erase is probably the wrong word, but until we confront the differences that have made the tiers of our society in the United States exist, along skin color lines, specifically. We're not. This is going to be another flash in the pan as far as progress, and for me, that was unacceptable. And I needed to understand what my part is in that. And it was very spiritual. It was very intimate. It was very God working on me. And I can't really explain otherwise that part of that was because there were some people that were pretty outspoken in the evangelical community that were very pro and then very against. It bothered me, but it made me focus on who I am and what I have to contribute to this conversation and to my own family and my own circles, and how people react or respond is up to them. But my truth is there, and though my story is unique, the story of Jesus is consistent, and I just don't see Jesus deserting anyone in their time of crying out, or of being upset that injustice was happening. And so in a non-militant, aggressive, you know, let's overthrow the Romans kind of a way, Jesus had much more of an impact in advocating for people that nobody else would touch, where nobody wanted to have that conversation. And I think that's where he put me in this round of exhibit of racism. You have to live in this. Like, you have to push into this. You have to be a part of this. You can't ignore this like you always have in the past. Or in fact, you can't side with the white experience in this one, because you need to remember. And then those memories became valid for me, became relevant to this conversation. And I no longer had to minimize my experience, because it wasn't slavery, or it wasn't death by police, or it wasn't the N-word. It was, but if we think of things, if we're truly talking equality, my experiences of racism are equal to others in that I got called out for being a different color. And that's what we're all upset at, I think. And instead of viewing the degrees of, it became, this is wrong, period. And I'm going to share with others how I've been wronged, not necessarily in search of an apology, but because it matters to me. And clearly, with my post, it was the first time that some of those that interacted with that had ever thought of things the way that I viewed them. So they were able to put the filter of John Waters, Korean American, the rest of my backstory into context, and then understand he never talked about these things before. I've never heard this from him. I just assumed he was some guy that just had a pretty easy life all along, and for lack of better description, just experienced whiteness.
Right. And what I love about the post, and maybe why it worked, is because of this spiritual tipping point that you're talking about that you've reached. It was offered in such compassion and in an openness, where maybe that tendency or that desire, that shadow that wants to judge or give a little push there towards someone, you resisted that and you let that spiritual kind of tipping point, as I said, lead you. And whenever, you know, you, in this case, when you did that, it invited people to come near to you, like a Samaritan woman towards the Savior, to say, I need this water. Speaking of spiritual, maybe a progression, confession, all these beautiful words, you've done a lot of great work with your sons, your kids, two sons and your beautiful daughter, in terms of their experience. And even you talked about, you know, in terms of the census, or, you know, how do they identify? What are the ways in which this spiritual awakening or the spiritual maybe peace is showing up in your day-to-day life at home, maybe at work?
Yeah, it's less along, you know, lines of the conversation around racism. Although we've had those conversations, I do not and have not and don't necessarily anticipate having the conversation about when you leave the house, these are the things that you need to be aware of or careful of, or if you get pulled over, this, that, and something else. It's a different experience. But the conversations that we've had about empathy, and this actually, the last time I was at this place of truly listening to the Holy Spirit was during Assad's his ongoing attack against his own people in Syria. And I for some reason interacted with that, and perhaps it was the orphan piece in me that this cannot be. Like, that made me respond. And there were various ways of doing that at the time. And it is ongoing. So unfortunately the spotlight is elsewhere now, but, we had that conversation. We do family church in our living room every morning, and we read, from scripture. We're in Luke right now. And we talk about whatever's going on currently. We talk about what's happened in our previous week and what we expect in our next week. We pray together and we share. And in my conversation, even around this topic, my middle child, Elliot, who is going to be a freshman next year, so eighth grade, had a flashback to a story in first grade where he felt uncomfortable around another person of color because of their skin color, and he didn't know where it came from. And this person had done some things to him that made him feel uneasy, but nothing to the degree of where I would think you would harbor that kind of resentment. But he just, 2 weeks ago, just starts emoting. And we were able to have that conversation that, yeah, when people wrong us and they also happen to be a skin color, that sticks with us. Yeah. But yes, forgiveness, but let's embrace that. Let's talk about why we feel that. Let's affirm that that is a natural human response to feeling wronged. And that for whatever reason, it also feels very natural to then create a stereotype around all people of certain skin colors. And to be able to deconstruct that with him in that moment, a family alive sitting around, was maybe the most beautiful thing I've experienced as a father. To have that provoked by our current narrative nationally, but then also God is doing things in even my middle school age child, on the level of he needed to get that story out. I never heard that before. I'd never heard him say anything. I'd never have a memory going back to first grade, and pinpointing the person and the instance and what happened around it. Like, the poor kid has been holding this, but for whatever reason felt safe to share that, and felt that it was important to say something. And we have since been able to have those conversations. Now we're 2 weeks raw in this, but have been able to rally to how he feels. He and I have had to have had the opportunity to have a conversation. And as a, we all embrace the fact that he is crying over how he felt about somebody he knows he shouldn't feel this way, because we're humans. There shouldn't be the differences, but because of actions or because of how we act toward others, we decide there's a hierarchy and we have our opinions, and usually it puts us on top, and everybody else is in some way inferior or wrong. And have him identify that as a middle school boy was pretty gratifying. And I think only because the Lord has chosen to, well, we have to make our home available to whatever the Lord wants to do. And then just step away from that and let him go to work. And I think that was manifest in a couple of weeks ago. And the only part I had to do with that was extend the invitation, the safety. And that carried over to the conversation because of what I experienced even on Facebook, such a rough source to express opinion or to make a point. But the love I received from that experience, I think then translated to how I related to trust and how I related to safety and how I related to, oh, if you put yourself out there occasionally, people will do the right thing. If you're sincere about how you're doing it, and it just facilitated the, how many conversations have we missed because of an unwillingness to truly be in the moment, to be available to people. And I just don't want to, be that in that place anymore. I want to be able to have the conversations in the moment with the people that want to, respond or reciprocate, not to argue necessarily, but to truly listen. And that's what I experienced this time and what I hope to extend to the Black community specifically. But also as a part of my family as well.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. I have a couple of last questions for you, John. Thank you so much for all you've been saying. Truly amazing. A lot of young people are the ones we see on TV these days protesting. They are, you know, the millennial generation who is truly engaged this time, perhaps at a higher level of consciousness, maybe more than even us older people. You work with a lot of young people. You've worked with a lot of millennials and Gen Zs, etc. What is your advice to this young generation who is out there advocating and truly wanting to make a difference in the world?
My first response is to make sure that you're willing to have the conversation. Because if you're just out there because it's sort of what I've experienced this time around, and it does happen every time, is that everyone sort of wants to insert themselves into the narrative. People want to suddenly showcase the fact they have Black friends too. And unless you're having ongoing conversations with those friends and their friends and people of color about how race has marked them in the United States of America, all the change, all the protesting, all the hashtags are kind of irrelevant because there's not the substance behind it. So don't just show up on stage because there's a camera rolling or because you want to feel like you're a part of something. Go back home, find where you live, find the people that are able to have that conversation with you, seek them out. They're probably maybe available to you even over social media. Smile at people. I guess try to engage instead of one of the things I have resented about this time around, but in the past, is when white people presume to speak for minorities. When they presume to believe they know what's best and how to best advocate. And I know that sounds difficult to process because there's been the request for help, join us. But I also need to know that you feel what I feel because of who you are.
I often say, join us, don't take over.
Yes. And I've had that. People do the right thing on my behalf, but it's been in an insincere way. And that's as hurtful as being on the other side of the line. And I spent an hour on the phone with a friend, white friend, right after the George Floyd video was shown. And after I spent this time on Facebook, and he spent an hour just asking me questions. Tell me your experience. Tell me why you feel like this is appropriation. Tell me why you feel like empathy or not empathy. Tell me why, how can I help as a white person? Like, I don't know what to do. I don't know your story. I don't know if it overlaps. I mean, but just the conversation. And I didn't have all the answer. Like, I don't even know. I'm part of this conversation here. Is formative. Like, it's trying to give me the opportunity to verbally process, and you let me talk this whole time.
You talk well. You speak really well.
to give me the opportunity to process what's going on internally and to butcher things, but then to grow in that. And so I think what I say, you know, over social media, what I say today, what I say the next day or next week, that will all be a part of my maturity, of my growth, of my feeling more like I can even approach adequacy with identifying with a Black man or with the Black community in what they've experienced most recently here. Because my experience is different, I just need to listen. But as somebody who is also a minority, I feel like to be a level of credibility that I instantly feel like I'm willing for the first time to truly join you as another minority, crying out for justice, crying out for change, crying out for the way it ought to be, the idealist in me. But the only way for me to do that is to be humble and to hear, and to, even if somebody says something that I absolutely don't agree with, to be able to respond to that and a sense of hearing and listening instead of judgment, or instead of forming my next words as argument back at. And that's what's different this time.
Powerful. Now, a last question, John. How, if people wanted to connect with you, I know you're not out there to build a platform unless you're running for office, if you want to make an announcement here. I mean, I'm all for special occasions, you know, and we need some good candidates. Okay, I guess we'll save it for 2024. But how can people follow your journey? Is there a place where people can connect with you?
And obviously on Facebook, it's you know, that's probably the easiest way to get a response, either message or post. It's just John Waters. And you can see the profile pic and probably identify me. I do get a little more hostile on Twitter, so that may
that's what it's for.
Yeah, that's right. But if that's of interest, I'm pretty even in that, but I'm not. Yeah. So that's J-Dub, J-D-U-B-B-2-3 on the Twitter. And then if people just want to have a blog or a conversation, entry level at that point, and I'll get on the phone or I'll text or I'll interact. However, it's all Zoom these days, right? I'd love to continue the conversation with anybody. I appreciate that invitation.
Of course. Yeah. I can't wait to have you back on the show. Before we leave, is there anything else that you want to say to our audience?
What I've learned in all this is if I'm truly humble, it means I set aside what has been done to me and that I have a right to. So in every other time, I felt like I've had a right to feel this way against or with. But that wasn't humility. That was some pent up anger, frustration from a lot of different angles and a lot of different areas of life. And again, not to say that I've mastered this, but in this round, it has been, okay, what don't I know? And let's be humble enough to know that I don't know. Even as a person of color, I don't know the experiences. I don't know of my own, Asianness doesn't know what Black, Brown, Yellow have experienced, Native Americans. So we need to have this conversation all together instead of just focusing on one person now or one kind of one flavor of race at this point, and include our brothers and sisters in any discriminated against color or class. And I think we take these and say, okay, we take a chunk out of it at a time. And sometimes it's LGBTQ, sometimes it's Black, sometimes it's Hispanic or Latin or whatever. Sometimes it's the poor but holistically, compassion is what it is. And that's what I would implore people to, when you see the person standing on the side of the road with a sign up saying that they're at their end and they need food, money, and you make assumptions, like compassion can go first. And it's much more freeing to have compassion and empathy and validating somebody because they're breathing as a human being, rather than to let your mind go through all the reasons. And for the first time, I think I was able to do that by embracing. I don't actually know that story. Like, I don't actually know what I think the stereotype is. And let's put that aside. Let's admit that and be all ears. And it's been a very freeing experience. And yeah, it's been difficult at times because you definitely hear things you don't want to hear. But it's been for me the best way to relate to currently the racism conversation in the United States right now.
Well, you definitely seem like a very free man, a very compassionate man, and it's a beautiful thing. It really is just like you were when we were in the same rooms. It's just an ongoing, I guess, just expression of your love that has always been there. And that's the joy that I have as a friend. But I think that's the same thing that people have hopefully captured here in these few moments, is the compassion, that compassion doesn't have to negate pain, that in fact, it makes it more tangible, more Christ-like, you know, to have that pain turn into wine, you know, turn into love. I think you've shown that. Well, my dear friend, we're at the end of the show. I want to just speak to my audience here. Shout out to a couple of comments here by our dear friend, Jordan. Hello, Jordan. He's here. He says, my guys, love you dudes. And then Nagel, by the way, John. And then he says, he's a good follow on Twitter. Trust me. Happy face. So, oh, man. You guys will have to follow that up on Twitter, I guess, afterwards. Thanks for this, guys. So, so good. Thankful for you, too. We're thankful for you, Jordan, as well. We love you, our dear brother in Christ. Well, John, thank you again for being here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the time.
No problem. Much love to all your family. Again, thank you, friends, for being here. As John said, he is available for you to follow him on Twitter or on his Facebook profile. I think if anything, just let his words truly ring in your heart how compassion is the way forward, and it doesn't preclude your own painful experience. In fact, we encourage you to speak about your pain because, as I've heard many times, it humanizes us as people. And I especially want to speak to my white brothers and sisters that your story matters as well. Your story isn't just of I'm a racist or my parents were racist or my, you know, 500 years of slavery. Your story includes compassion. It includes support and resisting alongside those who are suffering. So speak up. We need your story. You don't need to be an advocate. You just need to be someone who's walking alongside of everyone else. Don't presume that you have to feel or think what everyone else is feeling. What we all want is for you to show up as your true self and to be counted and to join arms, because we are all needed in this beautiful journey called life. Thank you again, everybody, for being here. And make sure that you follow me. The best place is to follow me on my podcast, where all of these interviews are there. You can listen in your earbuds while you're out working out or in the home, at home, where we mostly are these days. I encourage you to follow me there as well as on YouTube. Just type in my name and you will be there. Thank you again, everybody, for being here. Make sure that you like, comment, subscribe, share this broadcast with your friends, and I will see you next time.
Thank you for listening to The David Trigg Show. Find the complete archive at davidtrigg.com or subscribe for free through the podcast app on iTunes or Stitcher on Android.
Each week, we bring you a message of joy, success, and personal power in spite of fear, anxiety, and depression. Because as we like to say, though there's pain in the night, gozo comes in the morning.